virtually none. And now we see this huge increase in 2020, almost 50 meta-analyses and reviews of yoga research, suggesting that the actual research studies are many, many more. In fact, you can see an example of some of these reviews and meta-analyses in this published literature, this one on the top on stress, immune functioning, neurophysiological, neurocognitive mechanisms, stress again, and self-regulatory mechanisms of yoga. And in fact, we've also published this book, The Principles and Practice of Yoga in Healthcare, which is really sort of a collection from 60 different yoga researchers internationally. And in chapter 4, we have the a review of the research on the psychophysiology of yoga. But taking you back historically a little bit, some of the early research was done looking at advanced yoga practitioners. This was a study done in the 1950s in India, where they traveled all over India to identify these yoga masters and hook them up to this recording equipment. And from this exhaustive study, they concluded that physiologically, yogic meditation represents deep relaxation of the autonomic nervous system. Now, the most important feature of this is the fact that what they're observing here is the ability to control internal state, both psychological and physiological. And that's important because this whole idea of self-regulation is really pretty much absent in modern society and certainly in modern medicine. And so this is something that yoga has to offer that modern medicine really is not really good at, because modern medicine is focused on the doctor treating the patient as opposed to the patient being able to self-regulate and change internal functioning. The autonomic nervous system is also very significant because this is one of the major systems that conveys the stress response in the body and the mind. It was actually called autonomic because it was believed to be automatic. So here is this idea that individuals, through these training practices, can change their autonomic functioning. And the same is true for the other branch or the other aspect of the stress response system, which is the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, whose output is the stress hormone cortisol. So we see self-regulation of cortisol levels as well. Of course, the postures are different than Western type of aerobic exercises. They're much more focused on isometric exercises, much more focused on flexibility and balance and coordinating the breath and meditation. On the physical level, there's many, many studies that provide very strong objective evidence that people who practice yoga, who've never done it before, can easily increase their flexibility, muscular endurance, and muscle strength. And so this evidence is very strong. And we believe that these exercises actually induce a relaxation effect through the mind-body connection more so than do aerobic type exercises. There's a physical relaxation is an important component in yoga practice. And of course, we practice Shavasana or corpse pose often at the end of our yoga classes. And this has actually come to the West, and it's been called a progressive muscle relaxation in the West. It's been in psychological therapy for decades. And this is just one study showing that simple relaxation, physical relaxation, can have an effect on the stress response. So here we can see perceived stress in this randomized controlled trial. The black bar is the physical relaxation group, reducing stress. The control had no change. Anxiety dropping, no change in the controls. Perceived relaxation increasing, less so in the controls. And even physiologically, a reduction in heart rate. Again, this is through control of the autonomic nervous system. And here's the response from the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. This is measures of the stress hormone cortisol. After this relaxation technique, you can see actually a reduction in cortisol levels. The control condition had no change. The other thing that's really critical in yoga practices is the pranayama, the regulation of breathing. And the most common form of breath regulation is the long, slow, deep breathing. And this has undergone a lot of study, and there's a lot of very exciting results. One of the major findings is its role in being able to help individuals cope with stress and emotion. And this is one such study in which they had a randomized controlled trial, and in both conditions, they gave the participants a stressful condition. And what the experimental group did was long, slow, deep breathing. And you can see how much less the stress response is than it is in the individuals that did not practice the slow breathing. Now, jumping to modern technology, to the forefront of how yoga works on the brain, techniques are called neuroimaging, and it's using these large machines such as the fMRI pictured here, which are very precise and can tell us during meditation practice in the scanner which parts of the brain are being involved, which gives us an idea of how these practices are working on the central nervous system. Now, one of the major questions that's been asked is, do the brains of meditators behave differently than the brains of non-meditators? Because that's the claim, that meditators feel that their central nervous system functioning has changed. There's many studies that have looked at this in long-term meditators, and indeed there are observed changes, as one example in this study. And in this study, the changes appeared in structures that underlie the attention network, and also those that relate to emotion and autonomic function. So there's a good match between what we see behaviorally in terms of emotion and autonomic function regulation and the changes in those regions of the brain involved in control of those. The attention networks are changing, and that makes sense because what is meditation is the control of attention, the focus of attention. And when you do that, you engage the attention networks of the brain, which over time leads to improvements in attentional control. This is another study that looked at a specific technique that was able to isolate a single molecule, in this case a neurotransmitter called GABA, well-known inhibitory neurotransmitter in the central nervous system that's been implicated in mood control. And what you can see in this study is from pre to post of a single yoga class, the levels of GABA were increased. They'd scanned before and after the yoga class. And that increase in the levels of GABA in the central nervous system was associated with improvement in mood state. So not only are we changing brain activity, we're also changing brain biochemistry with these practices. Now, another feature of the central nervous system is its ability to change structure with time with different behaviors. And that's what yoga is. It's a certain set of behavioral practices. And in this study that was conducted at our National Institutes of Health, they looked at long-term yoga practitioners. And they were measuring tolerance to pain, in this case, cold pain tolerance. So in this chart on the left, you can see the black dots are the long-term practitioners. They are clustered at the high end of cold pain tolerance, whereas the non-practitioners are clustered at the low end of pain tolerance, suggesting there's something about long-term practice that makes you able to tolerate pain more effectively. And then on the vertical axis, what they also did was that they scanned the brains of these individuals and looked at the volume of the region of the brain involved in pain regulation. And what they saw was that on average, the volume of that region of the brain in long-term practitioners was larger than it is in the non-practitioners. Furthermore, they looked at the duration of practice of the yoga practitioners and were able to see a correlation between how long they had practiced yoga and how large that region of the brain was, such that the more they had practiced, the larger that region of the brain had become. So this now tells us that not only are we changing brain activity, brain biochemistry, we're also changing brain structure. And these are very powerful objective measures of brain functioning. So this puts us on a very solid footing. And not only these objective changes, the degree of these changes are just as significant as any kind of pharmaceutical that you may be able to take. So this caption reads, "Meditation isn't what you think." And of course, what happens when you meditate is that you focus your attention, you gauge the attention networks, you focus on a mantra, you focus on the breath. And then after a certain period of time, you notice that the mind is wandering. So in real life, what happens during meditation is that you're focusing your attention, your mind slips into mind wandering, and then you notice that and you bring the focus back to the attention target. And that is how meditation appears for everyone. Virtually everyone that meditates has that experience of this alternation between meditation and mind wandering. So in fact, if we really want to understand how meditation works, we need to understand how it appears in the real world, which means understanding mind wandering as well. And mind wandering has become a target of interest. This is a paper that was published in our premier journal, Science, studying mind wandering in the general population. And what they found was that people's minds wandered frequently regardless of what they were doing. So this is no surprise. Everybody knows that your mind is always wandering when you're standing at the bus stop or sitting in the doctor's office. People were less happy when their minds were wandering than when they're not, suggesting that there's an emotional cost to allowing your mind to wander excessively. And I think the reason for that is in the content of mind wandering, because what we're mind wandering about most of the time is what's most important to us, and that is survival issues. And survival issues inherently have uncertainty. So you're thinking about whether you're going to make enough money to send your child to college. You're thinking about whether you have enough money to pay the rent next month. These are all stressful thoughts. They're survival thoughts. And if you're constantly allowing those thoughts to engage, you're having stress responses. 24/7, 365 days of the year. Ultimately, if you allow that to go unchecked, you're going to end up with a mood disturbance. And that could lead to chronic stress, anxiety, and even depression. So what happens when we meditate? Well, we focus our attention, and when we do that, mind wandering ceases, at least for the period of time that you're successfully holding your focus. So it's kind of like a holiday from mind wandering, if you will. But what's more important is that as you practice meditation over time, you're learning the skill of controlling your own attention networks. And ultimately, this leads to a change in your relationship with your own thought processes. You are now able to self-regulate your thought processes more effectively. You become less emotionally and stress reactive to your own thoughts. You come to the realization that thoughts are just thoughts, and that's not who you are. And that describes a state we call metacognition, this realization that you are not your thoughts and you have the ability to self-regulate thought processes. And in fact, we can see this pattern of meditation in the brain scanner. And this is a study that was done with people meditating in the scanner, and they were able to look at the brain activity during the focus phase of meditation when people are successfully holding their focus. And what's being activated is the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, which is in the frontal lobes of the brain where the attention networks are. This is your executive regions of the brain. However, when the mind is wandering, an entirely different pattern of brain activation is taking place. It's a much more diffuse collection of brain regions, and this has been called the default mode network. So very different pattern of brain activation between these two. So we're starting to understand how the brain is behaving during these states. And we're starting to understand the connections between different brain states. So, for example, we know that there are inhibitory connections between the prefrontal cortex and our limbic system, which is the emotional brain where emotions and stress response are manifested. And so we're starting to see how meditation allows us to engage in this self-regulation of both stress and emotion. Thanks to yoga, I now gently stretch to conclusions instead of jumping to them. So this is our cartoon, really illustrating this idea of increased self-regulation of emotional reactivity. And as I said, stress is a major player here. And in fact, I know you have a speaker coming up in this expert series who's going to talk about yoga for stress. If when people ask what is the most powerful, important, immediate effect of yoga, it's actually in stress management. And so not surprisingly, a lot of studies are really have shown this ability of yoga to improve stress. This is actually a survey study we did in Austin, Texas, in a group of yoga studios asking beginners yoga practitioners why they were coming to yoga class. And stress management was one of the three main reasons that people were coming to practice. So it's really a well-known phenomenon that draws people to yoga class. In fact, as I said, there's a lot of studies that have been done and a few systematic reviews. This one here, published just very recently in 2020, concluding that most types of yoga have positive effects on stress reduction in healthy populations. Not only that, and those studies often are measuring stress from the psychological perspective of perceived stress. However, we can measure objective measures of stress, like the stress hormone cortisol, ambulatory systolic blood pressure, heart rate variability, blood glucose, and even blood lipids. And we can see positive changes related to the reduction in stress, which indicates that yoga is working fairly effectively for improved regulation of the sympathetic nervous system, which is part of the autonomic nervous system, and the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal system through the stress hormone cortisol. Now, just to give you a couple of examples, I've been working with the Kripalu Center for Yoga and Health, who's developed this program called RISE, which they're bringing into the workplace, particularly for stressful workers like first responders, educators, and for health and human services. And one of the studies we've done is on teachers and educators. So after a six-week program of yoga, we saw in this randomized control trial a reduction in perceived stress in the RISE yoga group here in the black going down. And at the long-term follow-up, 2 months later, after they're in their home environment, you can see that those improvements had been maintained. And the same is true for resilience distress. You can see this increase in resilience. So what's happening is these people are acquiring this skill of self-regulation of stress, and it's manifesting in reduction of perceived stress and improved resilience. We've seen the same in a study we conducted actually in Harvard physicians. What you can see here in this single group trial is a reduction in perceived stress that was maintained 2 months later, and an increase in resilience that was also maintained 2 months later. Frankly, counselor, I don't care how stressful this is for your client. Tell him to get out of that damn yoga position. Now, another thing that comes with yoga practice is this increase in what we call mind-body awareness. And this comes from the engagement of the attention networks in the act of meditation. It's attention that allows us to be aware. And as you improve the ability of your mind to hold its attention, engaging the attention networks, you improve your mind-body awareness. This has also been called mindfulness, which has become very popular in modern psychology. In fact, there are a number of surveys that can measure mindfulness, and this is a survey that was conducted in Germany with yoga practitioners. And what they did was they divided up the yoga practitioners into whether they were practicing at a high level, at a moderate level, or marginally. And what you can see is that there's a dose-response relationship. The more people practice intensive yoga, the higher their scores are on mindfulness, suggesting that there's something about yoga practice that improves this construct of mindfulness. And certainly the biggest candidate for this is the meditative component of yoga. We can also see mindfulness improvements even over the short term. So this is that same study in education professionals. We saw statistically significant improvements in mindfulness at the end of the yoga program, which were maintained at the long-term follow-up. And the same was also true in two studies we conducted, one in Harvard physicians, increasing mindfulness, and another study in Harvard medical residents. And that was a randomized controlled trial. You can see this improvement in mindfulness, which is largely maintained at the long-term follow-up, but no real changes in the control condition. And then finally, we've also seen this in studies in young adult musicians at the Kripalu Yoga Center. We were able to show that after just 6 weeks of yoga, we could increase their scores of mindfulness and on a number of subscales related to mindfulness. Now, yoga historically was focused on this whole idea of this unitive state. Yoga means union, and it's really focused on that spiritual experience. And what you can see with yoga practice is that there's a sort of a temporal change as you begin to practice. Over the short term, and this can happen over minutes, certainly over a yoga class, this is a sense of arousal reduction, the sense of physical and mental well-being. Now, as you practice over time, you start to develop the skills. You see changes in brain activity, you see changes in brain structure, and that's associated with these improvements in these skills and characteristics of mind-body awareness or mindfulness, improvements in resilience and stress, and overall self-regulation of internal state. But what many people experience now, typically over a longer term, now we're talking about months and years of regular sustained practice, many people talk about a psychological or philosophical transformation. They will use the words, yoga changed my life. In fact, I've even heard some people say, yoga saved my life. Now, what they're talking about here is something much deeper and much more profound. They're talking about an entire change in their life perspective that was precipitated by yoga practice. And where I think that comes from is from the deeper experiences that happen to occur during the meditative state in yoga practice. People experience this deep, unitive state of feeling one with everything. And that is a very powerful spiritual type of experience and can lead to an overall transformation in individuals. Now, we can actually measure this. This was the same German study of long-term yoga practitioners, and they had a spiritual well-being questionnaire that they applied. And again, you can see the dose-response relationship. Those that were practicing yoga at the higher level had the highest scores on spiritual well-being compared to those that were practicing moderately and those that were only practicing marginally. And on subscales of this questionnaire, on positive psychological states, such as hope, connectedness, and experiences of sense and meaning. Again, it's really the high level of practice that really shows these remarkable improvements in these deeper psychological, positive psychological states. In fact, we can even see these changes over the short term. There's not a lot of studies that have evaluated this, but this is the study we did with Kripalu Yoga in young adult professional musicians. And after just 6 weeks of yoga, we were able to show that the state called flow, which is this immersive, unitive state with their music practice, was improved compared to a control condition in which there were no changes. And the subscale of this questionnaire, autotelic experience, this is really this unitive state. In yoga, we call this the samadhi state. So during their music experience, they had an increase in that type of experience during their music performance after just 6 weeks of practice. So this leads me to what we call a logic model, which is really a summary slide that summarizes all of the psychophysiology and the mechanisms that we know about how yoga practice works. So as we've mentioned, yoga is this multi-component practice, not just asanas, but also the breathing, relaxation, and the meditation. Now, all four of these lead to this box here, which I'm calling fitness, which is improvements on the physical level. So that means things like flexibility, physical strength, coordination, balance, respiratory function, which through the mind-body connection leads to a sense of relaxation and stress reduction, and also a self-efficacy. Now, it's also through all four of these components, either together or independently, we improve self-regulation of internal state. The most important characteristics are stress regulation and emotion regulation, and over time, this leads to these very powerful characteristics of resilience to stress and equanimity, the evenness in the face of the ups and downs of emotions and life's challenges. And that leads to an overall psychological self-efficacy. Now, it's largely through the meditative component, the focus of attention, that we increase our mind-body awareness, also called mindfulness, engaging the attention networks. And as you engage the attention networks, the consequences of that are improved cognition, concentration, and ultimately self-regulation of thought processes, which what we call this very powerful state, metacognition. And it's largely through the meditative component, but typically over a much longer period of time, in which we see the induction of this unitive state, this experiences of transcendence, flow, which leads people to this deeper transformation, a change in life, meaning, and purpose. And I'm calling this box pure spirituality. Now, one thing you can see from this model is that we're making changes across a broad spectrum of human functioning, from the gross level of muscle and connective tissue to the deepest experiences that humans can have. The other thing that this allows us to look at is the degree of research. We have very, very strong objective research on these physical changes because we can measure these in degrees and limits of motion. And over the past two or three decades, the powerful techniques of brain imaging, molecular biology, biochemistry have allowed us to really come to a deep understanding of how yoga practices are improving self-regulation and mind-body awareness or mindfulness. And the weakest part in terms of research is this whole idea of induction of spirituality. But I believe that it is very possible to do these kinds of studies. So the other thing that's apparent here is these arrows that I put between the boxes. Although these boxes allow us to understand this very well, none of these things are independent. They're all interactive. So that's what these arrows are really there to do. Now, because of this broad spectrum effect on many different functions, what we're ending up with is this change in what I'm calling global human functionality. That includes physical and mental health and physical performance. And at a deeper level, the skills of stress and emotion regulation, awareness, mindfulness, and metacognition. And then ultimately to these deepest experiences of positive behavior change, improvements in well-being, life values, life purpose and meaning, and what we can call pure spirituality. And if you look at all of these characteristics, there's relevance for this for yoga's application in many applied circumstances. Certainly for yoga therapy, for treating mental disorders, this is certainly the case. So stress is a driver for most psychological and psychiatric conditions. Things like anxiety and depression are driven by stress. The lack of mind-body awareness can allow people to engage in behaviors that can cause risk factors for disease. And then, of course, physical fitness. I mean, we are in a sedentary society, and this is leading people to low levels of physical activity. And so this kind of the physical level can really improve physical functioning. So we can extrapolate from these mechanisms to how yoga may be useful for yoga as a therapeutic intervention. So this whole field of yoga as therapy has engendered its entire field of research. In fact, there's more publications these days on a frequency basis in studying yoga for specific disorders than there is in studying yoga for specific healthy populations in terms of mechanisms and psychophysiology. And we reviewed this literature and published this in 2015. This was a bibliometric analysis. In which we looked at the frequency of publications of studies that had been done and published in peer-reviewed medical journals that looked at yoga for some kind of disease condition, either psychological or physiological. And what you can see in the overall curve of all the publications in the purple curve, this remarkable trend over the past couple of decades from 2000. Not only is it growing in quantity and frequency, it's also growing in quality. This orange curve here are the randomized control trials, which are the more rigorous types of research design. So that is also increasing as we move forward in this field. In terms of research design, that gives us a sense of how rigorous this field is. It really is a new field of research. And in any new field of research, it's not well funded. And a lot of the studies are very primitive. So that's why we have a good percentage of uncontrolled trials, single group trials without a control condition. 18% of the trials in 2015 were controlled, and less than half were this gold standard of research design, which is the randomized control trials. And what we're starting to see over time is the shift. So we're starting to see more and more of the randomized control trials as we become more confident, as the funding starts to increase, as the body of evidence really becomes more solid in terms of yoga's benefits. We can also look at what these studies were looking at in terms of disorders, and the big three are the big three diseases that cause the greatest degree of death and morbidity: mental health conditions, mostly depression and anxiety; cardiovascular conditions, that's both heart disease and hypertension; respiratory conditions such as asthma and chronic obstructive pulmonary disease. Musculoskeletal conditions has been dominated mostly by back pain and by arthritic conditions. And then there's a huge body of research on cancer. And the goal here is not to cure cancer, but to treat the side effects of cancer treatments and also the stress and anxiety associated with a cancer diagnosis. Diabetes also has undergone a lot of research, especially in India, where they have a high incidence of type 2 diabetes. And we've, as I've noted, we've published this book, The Principles and Practice of Yoga in Healthcare. This is written in medical language by yoga researchers, and it's written for the healthcare system. This is essentially our statement to the medical community that yoga has a place in modern medicine. It's written with 23 chapters, each showing the theory, rationale, and research and practice of yoga for a variety of different conditions, including yoga therapists who were providing examples of how yoga could be applied. So this is really sort of our passport, if you will, to try and get ourselves into the medical system. And the other aspect that we see now is this growth of the number of research journals that are out there. The oldest research journal is Yoga Mimamsa, published out of Kaivalyadham in India. And our journal has been published over the past 25 years, the International Journal of Yoga Therapy. But now there are dozens of journals devoted to research on yoga. So this area, this whole idea of publications is really expanding dramatically. Yoga is actually part of a broader movement in modern medicine called integrative medicine, complementary and integrative medicine. And the leading organization is the Academic Consortium for Integrative Medicine and Health. And as you can see from this older website, yoga and meditation are very well represented. This organization has a meeting every year. And again, you can see that yoga and meditation practices are well represented. And for all of the previous 10 years of this meeting, I've successfully held a symposium on yoga research within this particular conference. Just to give you a couple of examples, and I'm just going to show you some of the research out of my laboratory. This is a study we did as a randomized controlled trial of yoga for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder. This was in a general population, a randomized controlled trial. The yoga is in the black bars. You can see on the PTSD symptom checklist, this reduction in the symptoms of post-traumatic stress disorder. The control group had no change. We saw improvements in resilience. We saw reductions in perceived stress in two different measures of stress. Another study we did, which has just been published this year in the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine, was a trial, a randomized controlled trial of yoga for chronic insomnia. This was compared to an active treatment called sleep hygiene. The yoga is in the purple, and you can see this reduction in sleep onset latency, the time taken to fall asleep, increases in total sleep time, increases in sleep efficiency, and reductions in a total wake time. And these were better than the in some cases better statistically than the control group, which is the sleep hygiene. And then the final example is a trial that we've just gotten published in JAMA Psychiatry, one of the leading biomedical journals. This was a randomized controlled trial comparing cognitive behavioral therapy, which is the gold standard of treatment for generalized anxiety disorder, compared to a Kundalini yoga intervention and a stress education control intervention. And what we saw was at the end of the 12-week intervention that both Kundalini yoga and cognitive behavioral therapy were superior to stress education. And what you can see is that there's a significant degree of efficacy. This is the increase in efficacy in the number of patients that have recovered from the disorder. And you can see that for our first trial of a yoga intervention for generalized anxiety disorder, we had really nice results. And so this is very encouraging. And it's very important for us to publish in journals like this because these make the largest impact and provide the strongest evidence for implementing yoga within healthcare. And ultimately, this will lead to things like yoga being taught in medical school, but also being reimbursed. Dean Ornish's work on yoga for heart disease actually led Medicare to cover their program reimbursement for heart disease. Okay, your posture is very good. Now relax, concentrate, and slowly let go of your cell phone. The first step in yoga therapy. And I just want to briefly talk about yoga for prevention, which I think is the biggest place yoga can have a very powerful impact. Non-communicable diseases are lifestyle diseases. They're chronic diseases. They're the leading cause of death in the worldwide. The world is reaching an inflection point. 15 million people will continue to die each year with NCDs. Most of these deaths tomorrow can be avoided. They're lifestyle diseases. These are cardiovascular diseases, cancer, respiratory diseases. They're responsible for almost 90% of all deaths. This is the biggest burden in modern medicine. In fact, another statistic is that 6 in 10 adults in the U.S. have a chronic disease, and 4 in 10 adults have two or more. So this is really an epidemic of these lifestyle diseases. 90% of our nation's annual healthcare expenditures are for these conditions. We're aware of this opioid epidemic, and the American Psychological Association is showing the increase in stress in modern society. Now, the problem with our healthcare system is that it's an acute care model. It's focused on treatment of symptoms, often with little attention to underlying causes. It's dominated by a disease-focused approach. It's invested in pharmaceutical, surgical, and highly technological diagnostic and treatment strategies. It's incentivized to emphasize speed, volume, and immediate symptom relief. The responsibility for healthcare is on the provider. Prevention and self-care or health maintenance is not emphasized. And although this is good for a car accident and for surgical procedures like that, this is not the way to go if you're dealing with an epidemic of lifestyle disease. You need to change behavior. And this is not happening in modern medicine. The focus in modern medicine is treating symptoms as opposed to addressing the underlying cause, which is these lifestyle issues. Yes, I believe in prevention. So can you give me a pill that will prevent me from having to exercise, eat less, and stop smoking and drinking? You know, this doesn't work and will never work. You cannot cure an epidemic of type 2 diabetes with a pill. It's not going to happen. You have to change behavior. Ask your doctor if taking a pill to solve all your problems is right for you. The answer is not in pills. We have to change behavior, and modern medicine is not good at changing behavior. These are the risk factors for these NCDs: physical inactivity, unhealthy diet, and unhealthy behavior such as cigarette smoking and excessive alcohol consumption. And behind all of these is the chronic stress epidemic. There are no pills for these things. There are no surgeries for these things. And modern medicine is having poor success at changing these underlying behaviors. However, when you look at our logic model for yoga, there's a very good match between what yoga can provide and what is needed to address risk factors. The fitness component can address the physical inactivity. The self-regulation can improve the chronic stress. The mind-body awareness can change behavior, including the physical activity and diet. And the spirituality component can really change people's life goals from materialistic, which we know are embedded with chronic stress, to more higher level goals of life. So yoga has these benefits of changing the possibility of changing behavior. And I'll quickly just give you some examples of this. This is a study of long-term yoga practitioners. They report general or excellent health. They don't smoke. They have higher levels of physical activity. And rating their mental health, 43% are flourishing mental health compared to only 21% in the general population. We also did a survey study of yoga practitioners and found, compared to non-practitioners, that they were using fewer of the drugs that are used for chronic health diseases. So fewer drugs for depression, for diabetes, for high blood pressure, for cholesterol, arthritis, and even pain. Furthermore, in this survey of long-term yoga practitioners attribute their improvements in health to the yoga practice. My health is improved because of yoga. 90% agreed or strongly agreed with that. And the same was true with happiness, sleep, energy level, and weight maintenance. In fact, there's even a randomized controlled trial that shows that in this randomized controlled trial, people that practiced yoga increased their levels of physical activity. This was due to participants' improved perceptions of ability, but also their increased self-awareness as a result of their experience. They became more aware of their body and felt that when they exercised, they were able to experience that positive benefit, so they were drawn to more exercise. This is the explanation of how mindfulness can change behavior. And that's also true in this study here, which looked at intrinsic motivation for physical activity, one of the risk factors for NCDs. In this yoga study, you can see from baseline to week 8 to week 16, there was an increase in this motivation for physical activity. So we're addressing the lifestyle issues behind NCDs. So I am funded and work very closely with the International Association of Yoga Therapists. I'm also the research director for the Kundalini Research Institute, which supports the style of yoga that I practice and promote. I'm also the director of yoga research for the Yoga Alliance, and my role here in this large organization is to promote research literacy amongst yoga practitioners and teachers. We have many yoga research videos, over 3 dozen research webinars that we've put on, and we also have a collection of reprints on yoga research in many different categories, and you can see these different categories. Relevant to yoga therapy, we have the whole category of diseases and disorders. This a collection of reprints, both review papers and individual studies showing the benefits of yoga in these many different conditions. This is free access, so anyone can go here and use this resource. And I end with this cartoon. And this is unfortunately this progression into the epidemic of non-communicable lifestyle chronic diseases. We do not have the strategies in modern medicine that are effective for preventing these disorders, in fact, even for treating them that well. And so we hope that through the yoga research, that will justify the ultimate implementation of yoga into modern medicine, and ultimately that can change this cartoon to this cartoon here. So I thank you very much for your attention, and I'm happy to address any questions that you might have.
Thank you, Satbir. This will help us reinforce why we practice yoga and hopefully bring in new people at the doorstep. So thank you for sharing that. I got one text message asking if there was any research in yoga for migraine. And personally, I was asked this by 2 other people also.
Yes, there are a few studies. It's not a large area of research, but the preliminary evidence shows that there are a few studies that have shown improvements in both headache and migraine. Generally, the research on neurological conditions like that is less, but nevertheless, there is positive evidence that that is the case. And one of the possible mechanisms, again, is through stress reduction.
So now I can, if anyone has any questions, please put it in the chat box. And there is some comment. Thank you for the book on principles and practice of yoga in healthcare. It is an amazing book and found it very useful. This is from one of our pelvic floor physiotherapists. And the next question is, can you show the slide again for the effects of yoga in schools?
Well, I didn't include a slide specifically for yoga in schools. But if you look at the logic model, you can extrapolate to the needs that are there in the public schools. And I'll share that slide again. Unfortunately, something has come onto my screen. There we go. So if you look at the logic model, I mean, one of the biggest problems that we face in our schools is this: there's no training in management of stress and emotion. This is a whole movement now that's coming into our public schools called socio-emotional learning. The argument here is that our schools have become basically factories for producing workers. The focus is on getting a job. And the focus is not in learning how to regulate your own stress and emotion, nor in fact in how to even maintain your physical body. The focus on physical education in yoga is largely focused at sports and muscular endurance, and not so much on the sort of the physical relaxation component. And then the mind-body awareness is critical. The mind-body awareness can really change behavior. It's awareness of your own thought processes. It's awareness of your own physical body that can change behavior. So we have anecdotes, for example. The one that's most striking to me is a student who went through our yoga program. And one of the comments that she made was that she was eating less junk food, less ice cream and candy. Now, we didn't give recommendations for diet. This came out of the increase in mind-body awareness. So how this works is this. You become more sensitive to your body. You become more sensitive to your mind. That means everything that you do now is perceived more intensively. So if you eat junk food, now you start to really experience the negative consequences of junk food. You may not have any problem before you took yoga with eating a lot of junk food, but after yoga, now suddenly it feels awful. So as soon as something feels awful, you automatically, because it feels awful, don't do it anymore. On the other side of things, you eat vegetables and you finally notice, hey, that felt really good. You want to eat more vegetables. The same is true with all the other risk factors for NCDs, including physical activity, as I've shown. People who never took yoga and then take yoga, their experience of going to the gym changes. Before yoga, it was like, okay, I did my duty. I went and I did my half-hour workout at the gym. After a few months of yoga, they go to the gym, they do their same workout, they say, wow, I felt really good after that workout. I want to do that some more. That's this increase in mind-body awareness. So it works both by enhancing positive behaviors and discouraging negative behaviors. And that is critical in the maintenance of lifestyle disease. That is really sort of the core that yoga can provide. And there's no drug for mindfulness. You can increase that. So this is something that yoga offers in terms of students in school settings that the education system is not currently offering. And in fact, modern medicine doesn't have skills that are offering that either.
Very informative, thank you. Any papers on the enlightened people and their health status?
Well, there's no studies that have correlated improvements in spirituality and health. However, the two very likely go together. because, you know, in terms of experiencing positive psychological states, if you have low back pain, it's very hard to experience a higher state because your whole center and liver system, your whole body is consumed with trying to cope with the pain of this condition, whatever it is, whether it's a migraine or low back pain. So the idea of being able to express this spiritual state is really optimizing body function so that everything is working perfectly. I mean, that's the underlying philosophical and theoretical approach to yoga. The idea is that you are trying to optimize mental and physical functioning to the point where the brain is so optimized that that region of the brain that expresses this spiritual state can be activated and you have this deeper samadhi, this deeper spiritual experience. So the two really go together hand in hand.
I have been teaching yoga in elementary school for 6 years and the response is truly marvelous. Self-regulation was strengthened and as was the resilience during the dramatic events. So that is one of our comments that was shared. And then I was awarded by my socio-emotional learning department at my school district for doing yoga with my class. Love hearing your collection of evidence. So that was one remark. And then there's a question. Thank you very much, Dr. Khalsa. Is there any difference in meditation with asana practice and without asanas?
So, I mean, again, something that, you know, you could study. That could be a great study. What's the effect on the meditative experience and the engagement of these networks in the brain with and without asana? The beauty of yoga is that all of the components work towards a common goal. So if you're doing mindfulness meditation alone, I think that you will have a stronger impact if you also incorporate the physical body, the breathing techniques, and the physical relaxation. And you know, it just makes sense. We know that all of these practices individually can have an impact on stress regulation, on mind-body awareness, on relaxation effects. So combining them all, obviously, makes more sense. And so I think it's very important to engage the body as well as mindfulness. I know that mindfulness has become extremely popular. It's the most trendy thing. It's everywhere. It's taking over psychological medicine. But I think that it just is not as good as yoga. Yoga is meditation plus.
Thank you. That's a very important and useful answer. And then we have Dr. Ajaya Joshi. He's going to be giving a talk on Thursday. He's put a remark here. Thank you. Much information on Thursday from me, building on your message of yoga as a broad tool for countering, reversing non-communicable disease as a part of yoga for spinal care. So we're looking forward to that. And then there's a bunch of thank yous.
And the back pain studies are there's two areas of research that have really been the strongest in yoga. One of them has been yoga for low back pain. And ultimately, this has led to consensus statements by the fields of low back pain research. So this is our evidence that, and the same is true for cancer. Consensus statements have been made for the importance of yoga as an option, as an alternative and perhaps complementary option for treating those conditions. So the research has grown to such an extent that we are actually having these consensus statements. And consensus statements are important because these are the statements that ultimately reach the primary care providers. These are the statements that make it into the doctor's office to say, look, this is new information. Yoga is now considered as a therapeutic option for cancer patients and for low back pain patients.
Just one more question, and I think then we'll make an announcement and then see if you have some time to stay back. But there's a wandering mind is an unhappy mind. Could you please emphasize more on how this is corrected by yoga?
So again, it's the focus of attention. Your attention networks can only do one thing at a time. They can either mind wander, which is a chain of thought. You know, it's hot in this room. I should set the thermostat. Oh, I have to pay the electric bill. Oh, yeah, I have to talk to my boss about the money. It's a chain of thought. That's mind wandering. And you're standing at the bus stop, and that's what's going on. That's what many people experience. When you focus your attention on something and you repeat Om or you focus on your breath, mind wandering ceases. So that's one aspect. You know, the attention networks are now focused, so you're no longer engaging in mind wandering. And as you practice this over time, this becomes a skill. You become better, like any behavioral activity, like riding a bicycle. Over time, you become better at riding the bicycle. As you continue meditating, you become better at controlling the attention networks. And that means you have more control, not just of choosing not to mind wander, but what also happens is that you realize, you come to a realization that you are not your thoughts, that mind wandering is not who you are. You are someone metta, above that. And that's what metacognition means. And that is associated with this improvement in your relationship to your own thoughts. You now become more of the master of those thoughts instead of the driven by those thoughts. And that is the whole idea of self-regulation of thought processes, which is ultimately manifesting as self-regulation of stress and emotion.
Okay, now we have a whole lot of questions. Sadhvi, you have some time?
Yes, absolutely.
Let me make a quick announcement and then get back to the questions.
Sure.
So, Kristen and Sherry, maybe Sherry can share about the Riverwalk class.
Absolutely. We'd like to invite all of you to attend this Saturday, either virtually or in person at the shops at River Center. We're going to have a virtual and in-person yoga class on our historic Riverwalk at 7 p.m. We have three wonderful local teachers, Melissa Aguirre, Carlos Gomez, and Jody Whitting, that will be presenting the class, as well as some dignitaries. And then we'll have the throwing of colors, which is so much fun. So we hope you can join us this Saturday at 7 p.m. And next we'll hear from Kristen Baggett. Kristen McKinney Baggett is the executive director of the nonprofit Local Yoga Day.
Thank you, Sherry and Hatal. And thank you so much. This was a wonderful hour. We just wanted to share very quickly the donations that are being made. Much of it goes to a grant toward my nonprofit Yoga Day. Yoga Day works to bring yoga and mindfulness and all of the benefits to people in San Antonio who might otherwise not have the experience, mainly children. So we're in many different schools and work with a lot of nonprofits. This year we were able to, thanks to last year's International Day of Yoga, we were able to provide discounted classes for the whole year to IDEA Public Schools, both for their children and their families. We were able to offer free virtual classes throughout the year for the Texas Continuing Education Association. We were able to provide free online family classes for families throughout the year for SAISD, as well as teachers and educators through Leadership San Antonio. We were able to provide free virtual classes for holiday camps for Girls Inc. and Girl Zone, and we're continuing that for spring break in the summer. And finally, we were able to offer free family events for the San Antonio Mayor's Fitness Council. So lots being done with your generous donations. Thank you so much, and we'll see you Saturday.
Thank you. And we can get back to questions before, or Maggie, maybe we can announce tomorrow's class and then get back to the question.
Sure. Hi, thanks so much for this. This was amazing. Thank you so much for our sponsors who have made this possible. So our main Diamond Plus sponsor, thank you to TIPS, Texas Indo-American Physician Society here in San Antonio. And our gold sponsors for this year, thank you so much to Kalalaya Indian Performing Arts, Dr. Devraj Nayak, and of course, HEB sponsoring our beautiful yoga mats to be given away to the first 100 to pre-register and join us in person on June 19th. And of course, thank you to all of our community partners who make this possible every single day. And with that, back to you, to Dr. Satbir Khalsa. Thank you.
All right, so the question was, there was one, what do you feel importance of mantras in meditation, especially chanting Om?
So the belief in yoga, of course, is that there are sacred words and that specific words such as Om have a special characteristic, that this word chanted as compared to a nonsense word or any other word has special features. There have been a few studies that have looked at om chanting, and they have shown that there are improvements in stress regulation. It's a meditative practice, and there are benefits. However, none of them have really done a sort of a really appropriate control to address this critical underlying condition. Is there something special about om? Some of these studies were done in India, and of course, om is known widely in India. So people doing some kind of control, I mean, you have to eliminate the uncertainties here. And one of the uncertainties is that om is reputed as a spiritual word. So if people practice this, then that is their understanding, and of course that's going to be reflected in their response. So you have to design an experiment in which you can compare sort of special words like om with nonsense words to really identify whether there's something special about the word in addition to the meditation practice. Because I can meditate on the word dog, and I'm meditating on dog, and that will generate the benefits of meditation. But will it be better to focus on something else? Of course, if you focus on the word love, you can imagine focusing on the word love is going to be more effective than dog, simply because we understand what the words mean and how different they are. And so it's very difficult to try and, from a scientific research perspective, to really make that conclusion. But having said that, don't wait for the research to demonstrate that mantras are special. Why not use them? If that's the claim, I mean, a lot of these yoga practices that have been developed over hundreds and hundreds of years. And if these mantras have been taught by these yoga masters, everything else they've taught seems to work. So why not go ahead and use the mantras? That is a belief, and it's likely to be the case. But we don't have the sort of scientific research to really nail that down at this point in time.
There's a question on, does yoga help with brain injuries? I mean, brain injury during birth due to medical negligence.
Well, that's a very specific topic, and certainly there's no research study on that. As I mentioned, there are studies on yoga for neurological conditions, and there are just about 3 to 4, maybe even half a dozen studies on traumatic brain injury showing some positive benefit of yoga practice. But these are preliminary trials, so there's a lot of work yet to be done. But yes, it's really remarkable how yoga has this sort of global impact on virtually every disease. But if you understand the logic model, you understand that stress is such a critical component in virtually every medical condition. Virtually every medical condition has a stress component. Because having a medical stress condition, medical condition is stressful. So if nothing else, you're improving quality of life. And that is improving the disease, likely, too. But stress is typically implicated in many of the mechanisms of different disorders. So for example, in type 2 diabetes, stress has a direct and immediate impact on glucose regulation. And glucose regulation is the underlying disorder. That's the underlying problem, is insulin resistance and glucose regulation. So if you're improving stress, you're improving glucose regulation by definition. So it has benefit for everyone. But how specifically it can be beneficial for different disorders is going to vary.
And there was one question I missed. Does yoga help with vertigo?
Not very many studies. The only studies that are most notable are those studying sort of nausea with chemotherapy in cancer patients. There's a few studies showing that yoga has helped with the nausea due to chemotherapy. But vertigo per se, I don't think there's many trials, if any. Again, research is happening so quickly. That, you know, we are seeing now 300 publications a year. So I don't have the time to read each and every paper that gets published these days. I mean, I used to be able to do that, but no longer. Just from the period of time between January 1st and the end of April, there were 150 yoga research publications. The majority of those, the vast majority of those, are yoga for a variety of different conditions. So it's very difficult to keep up with the literature, and the literature is, if anything, accelerating and growing.
So that's it on questions. Again, thank you, Satbir, for being so patient and answering all these questions and sharing the wealth of information. We are really grateful for your time and expertise and wealth of knowledge. And we will hope to see you again in person, maybe soon next year. And that's it from me. I'll give it to Maggie to make an announcement for tomorrow's class.
Thank you very much.
Namaste, Dr. Satbir Khalsa. Always a pleasure to see you and gracing us with your amazing insights and research for our modern day lifestyle concerns. Yes, if we can join us tomorrow night, please, as we continue our continuation of nightly speakers. Tomorrow, Monday, we will be welcoming to the stage Eddie Stern, author and yogi, and he will be talking about yoga and the healing response, One Simple Thing. Again, Monday, June 14th at 7 p.m. Central Daylight Time. Please follow us here to register and get your Zoom link. Join us online at idoyogasa.org. And if you're not able to join us via Zoom, please follow us on Clubhouse, where you can listen in via an audio listen-in platform available for iPhone and Android users now. Please visit our website, idoyogasa.org, for more information. And if you're on the Zoom link right now, you can check the chat box and click on the link to join us now on Clubhouse for an after-party discussion on this amazing topic and just to share insights and further questions. Thank you so much, and we hope you will join us tomorrow night.
Thank you again. So we'll conclude with the Shanti Mantra. Om Sarve Sham Swastir Bhavatu. Sarve Sham Shantir Bhavatu. Sarve Sham Purnam Bhavatu. Sarve Sham Mangalam Bhavatu. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Thank you, everyone. Namaste. Good night. Shubhratri. All right. So we'll log off if there is no questions or anything that anybody has to say. Maggie, I think the link is shared for enough amount of time. Can I log off?
Yes, no problem.
Okay, good. Thank you, Maggie.